Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Gustavo Arellano, who reads from and discusses his new book, Orange County, A Personal History, published by Scribner. In the weeks to come, we have Candace Bushnell, Neil Stevenson, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Just a moment. It's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, I'd like to thank you for coming to tonight's event and for your support of independent bookstores. Tonight we are pleased to welcome Gustavo Arellano, who will read from and discuss his new memoir, Orange County, A Personal History, in which he shares the story of his family's immigration and the evolution of Orange County, California, from America's Orange Grove heartland to the country's modern immigration destination. Gustavo was born in Anaheim, California, to a tomato canner and an illegal immigrant. His award-winning Ask a Mexican column is carried by 32 weekly newspapers, including Denver's Westward. He's a contributing editor to the LA Times and has appeared on the Today Show, Talk of the Nation, and the Colbert Report. Please join me in welcoming Gustavo Arellano.
Thank you very much for coming out. Let me just take a drink of water here and we'll get started. Sorry, I haven't had food today. I'm coming from New York because I had a book signing yesterday and my flight was delayed about an hour and a half. And the reason I wasn't eating was because the Westward people, they have the humongous food event going on. But they said, before that, we're going to take you to real Colorado green chili. And I'm a big old foodie. So I'm like, okay, fine. I'll just starve myself until we get to the green chili. I didn't come in until 6:30 and I had to get to the hotel and do all that stuff. So if I'm delusional, sometimes it's because I'm starving. But anyways, thank you for coming out here. I was here last year and, I always love coming to Denver just because the crowd's really receptive and there's a lot of people who read the column, my Ask a Mexican column in Westward. And for those of you who have never heard of the column, it's really succinct. It's exactly what it sounds like. People send me questions about Mexicans. Oh, she has it right there. Good. That's a good woman. People send me questions about Mexicans and I answer them. And, it doesn't matter what type of questions they are. They could be racist or sexist or serious questions, questions about language, questions about midgets or tomatoes. I've received every type of question. And the purpose of the column is specifically to debunk stereotypes and misconceptions that people have about Mexicans by just really digging into the truth of a particular question, a particular thought or whatever. And in that sense, the sense of debunking and explaining, Ask a Mexican was a natural first book and also the gateway for me to do the book actually I had always wanted to do, which is this book here, Orange County, Personal History. And if you get this book, it's actually two books in one. You have one side of the book, or not one side of the book, but alternating chapters go between the history of Orange County, how it's influenced the rest of the United States, and also the history of my family, my family going back and forth four generations between Anaheim, California, and Zacatecas, which is a state in central Mexico. And I know a lot of people from Zacatecas live in Denver, because if you go to the Zacatecas Airport, it only has three American destinations: Chicago, Denver, and Los Angeles. So I actually don't have any cousins who live in Denver. All of us were in Los Angeles or Chicago, and a couple of us in Chicago, but I do know a lot of people from Zacatecas who go to Denver. So those two stories for me as a journalist have been my obsession, to debunk the stereotypes behind Orange County, to debunk the stereotypes behind Mexican immigration. So what I'm going to do then, I'm going to divide my speech into both of them and, read a little bit from the Orange County part, read a little bit from the Mexican part. So I'll start with the Orange County part. And, in the past, well, Orange County has always played a particular role in the American imagination. Before the 1950s, it was this beautiful wonderland, Eden on the West Coast, because the way Orange County got its original fame was for its orange industry. The orange industry, at one point, they were, specifically Orange County alone, they were delivering about a third of all the Valencia oranges, that's the one that makes the juice, to the rest of the United States. And what the orange growers would do, they would pick the oranges, and then they would put them in these orange crates, and each orange crate had a label signifying what was the name of the particular grower. And these orange crate labels now are works, they're antiques, they're valuable collector's art, and they're really beautiful things. They had, they would have these art deco illustrations of orange groves leading up to the foothills, leading up to the mountains with missions, and, or maybe they'd have Spanish senoritas fluttering themselves, and the names were very evocative. They were like Esperanza, Old Mission Brand, Anaheim's Best, and those images put it into the minds of the United States that Orange County is this wonderful place. Of course, those orange crates also didn't show who were picking the oranges. They weren't showing people like my great-grandfather, my grandfather. I'm jumping a little bit ahead here, but they weren't showing the Mexicans who were picking those orange groves who were forced to live in segregated citrus camps, really shoddy citrus camps, and whenever they would try to protest for higher wages or go on strike to unionize, they would get brutally suppressed. But again, I'm going a little bit ahead of myself. So that was Orange County in the American imagination before the 1950s. After the 1950s, it became a place of progress. Well, really, it became the suburb of Los Angeles, but really where American GIs, they could get the GI Bill and get their little piece of the American dream. And so one of the main ways how Orange County then became famous is through Disneyland. Disneyland was created from orange groves in Anaheim. Walt Disney came in and just bought up a lot of land, not enough land as it would turn out, and he created Disneyland, which of course then became just an iconic part of 1950s pop culture and to this day. The next way then that Orange County became part of the American imagination was really the stereotype that for the most part continues to this day, but now that's a little bit changing, but basically Orange County is a home of wacky, crazy right-wing Republicans. The craziest of the craziest, it's where, it's a place that Ronald Reagan once said, all good Republicans go to die. And even the Republican Party in Orange County to this day, they just say that as gospel. You say, look, the great communicator said Orange County is the place where all the great Republicans, therefore, we're the best Republicans in the world. And so you trace the coverage of Orange County through from the 1960s through the 1970s, and it's really, really negative. Just, for some reason, Times Magazine just had it in for Orange County, specifically for the Orange County Register, the daily newspaper there. Fortune Magazine called us nut country. Harper's Magazine said this is like the place where the worst of the worst come to mind. And I think that's what happened because the liberal media at the time, they were freaked out about what was happening with Orange County, because the Goldwater Revolution really reached its apotheosis in Orange County. Of course, Barry Goldwater, even though he lost in 1964, he would go on, his followers would go on to elect Ronald Reagan to the governorship of California in 1966, and they were the same people that then elected Richard Nixon in 1968 to the White House, and we know the rest of the story. In fact, years later, when Goldwater was now, retired, and he'd go around the country raising funds for the Republican Party, he would always say that, he would boast actually that, I lost horribly to Lyndon Johnson during 1964, but I did carry five states and Orange County. And so that was a stereotype. It's still with us to this day, but really for the past, I would argue most of this millennia, actually, since 2000, Orange County has gotten a new image as this cool, awesome, hip, happening place. And I hate to use those cliches, but they're not my cliches. Around 2002 or so, 2003, all of a sudden, newspapers and magazines and television networks started telling the American people that Orange County was the coolest place in the country. USA Today called us America's capital of cool. I don't know why. It's really goofy. VH1 made an entire one-hour special about how awesome and how cool and how great Orange County was. And even stodgy U.S. News and World Report called us America's hip factory. And it was all about this idea that there's all this surfing industry here, all this pop music coming out, and all of those ideas happened before the plague of the horrible television shows that were about Orange County. Maybe some of you have known about them or just hear it and just wince. We had The O.C., Laguna Beach, The Real O.C., The Real Housewives of Orange County, which continues and is one of the worst shows you'll ever see. Horrible, horrible show. It really is bad. I mean, there are some shows like Project Runway that you could appreciate as a guilty pleasure. You can't do that with the Real Housewives of Orange County. Desperate Housewives, that was actually, it wasn't about Orange County. It doesn't really say where the location is, but it was created by an Orange County resident. Ocean Force, Huntington Beach, and then the only great show about Orange County, which was the one that got canceled, Arrested Development. And Arrested Development is just an amazing, amazing show. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. So Then in that case, you know, the ways that I've described Orange County being, you know, playing a role in the American mind, it's always as this exotic, strange, crazy location. But that sort of treatment, I think, really does a disservice to Orange County. And so what my book talks about then, it's not just a civic history of Orange County. It's not just a... not just about our pioneers or any of that stuff, because nobody outside of Orange County would give a damn about the Yorbas and Peraltas and Anaheim being founded by socialist, hippie, orgy-loving Germans. No one would care about that stuff. But so what I did then, I devoted chapters to... where we are. Okay. I devoted chapters to the major themes that I think in the way Orange County has influenced the rest of the United States. So what I'm going to do right now, I'm just going to read a little, just a little bit about, from the introduction from Orange County, just sort of my, argument as to why I wrote the parts about Orange County and why everyone else should care. So, and this is concluding after I give like a 5-page quick summary of all the boring parts of Orange County, but that you need to understand to really get the rest of it. So I go. Thus concludes my history of Orange County, at least a short version. I doubt you want to read about the minutiae of our megaburb, how Catella Avenue, one of the county's main roads, is named for Kate and Nella, the daughters of a prominent Anaheim farmer, that the Yorba family was one of Orange County's most important early settlers. And what about the ancient legend that the reason the Anaheim Angels didn't win for decades was because their stadium was built on an Indian burial ground? Too bad that story is baloney. Anaheim Stadium was actually built on an old orange grove, a grove where my uncle gathered naranjas as a 12-year-old. But I digress yet again. All good trivia, but hardly reason enough to read my book, ¿que no? Municipal histories are fascinating, mostly to those who live there. The public at large demands a connection, a reason to read about a place far away. With that in mind, I present to you the Orange County that witnesses, initiates, and fosters movements that transcend our borders and influence the arc of American life, even the world. Hell, there's even an Orange County in China modeled after us. The fact that commies look upon Orange County as an ideal for good living indicates that something about my homeland is weird and vital. Our conservatives, our churches, our quote-unquote real housewives, anti-immigrant fools, and captains of avarice, all are many manias for major swaths of the country. So we notch the television shows, muchos articles, increased tourism, even a Jack Black flick. But never, there was a movie called Orange County with Colin Hanks, so that wasn't a good movie either. But never a serious book outside academia's necessary but boring realm. Nothing has exposed Orange County in its unadulterated, bizarre, fascinating whole until now. Sorry, Meet the OC Superstar's official biography doesn't count as a real book. Oh, local historians have regaled readers with tales of pioneers in the halcyon days when the John Birch Society reigned and the county smelled like a giant can of Tropicana. But the victors write history, goes the aphorism, and nowhere is that more true than in Orange County. Local histories follow a tight OC story, positivist and predestined steps and outcome. Good for retirees, terrible for the macro view. We don't care for the fact, we print the legend. Meanwhile, American historians have long dismissed the county as America's fundamentalist wild child, reviled as a place that spawned Nixon, ridiculed for the perfection that drew so many to find lives of leisure. We're historical ether, we're invisible, but we're dangerous. And I'll read a little bit more later on. So you know, that's just sort of the short introduction to that. But then the chapters themselves, I devote to the main themes. So one chapter, it's devoted to how Orange County influenced master plan communities in the United States. All across the country now, you know, there's this buzz about McMansions and just cookie cutter housing. Really, that phenomenon started in Orange County. The original retirement communities, the leisure worlds, or I don't know, elite, that's how they're called in Orange County, or seizure world, if you want to be funny. But the idea of retirement communities really gained acceptance in Orange County, because before that, there was a movement against it. They thought that retirement communities would be geriatric ghettos. But in Orange County, they found their apotheosis. So did master plan communities. So I talk a little bit about that, how Orange County influenced that. There's a chapter devoted to the Republican Party, how our present administration can trace its roots directly to Orange County, and all the good things about it. Like you might have heard earlier this week with our whole financial crisis, how John McCain said we should fire as the head of the SEC, Christopher Cox. Well, Christopher Cox used to be a long-term congressman from Orange County, And he should be fired because you could blame most of the financial crisis specifically on him and on his motives. And also you could blame the subprime mortgage scandal on Orange County. AmeriQuest was based there, Countrywide Financial. A lot of the people that just are making our country buckle, you could blame us for it. I talk a lot about what's so strange about our conservatism and why ultimately we should be glad that we don't have too much of an influence, because if we had too much of an influence, our country would be much worse than what it currently is right now. I devote another chapter to religion. Orange County is probably, well, next to Colorado Springs, actually. Harper's Magazine said this, and in 2005, Harper's Magazine did this great, they actually did the first expose on Ted Haggard, the great pastor down there. And so in that, they did an article, they made a comparison. They said Orange County and Colorado Springs are America's two main nexus points for American Christianity. So we all know about Colorado Springs, focus on the family, and all these big things. But I would argue, and I do argue in the book, that Orange County, it has a bigger influence worldwide. The largest televangelical network in the world is Trinity Broadcasting Network. They're based in Costa Mesa, right across the freeway from South Coast Plaza. And if you guys know anything about TBN, you probably know about this way. If you're flipping through channels at about 2 a.m. in the morning, and then you see a rotund woman, to be nice, wearing a massive wig that's either purple or pink or whatever. That's Jan Crouch and the husband's Paul Crouch, who has this big mustache with white hair. And they're the ones who preach the prosperity gospel. If you give me $1, God will give you back $100. And so they make millions and millions of dollars off of that. That's just Orange County progress, right? The most watched Christian television show in the world is The Hour of Power. The Hour of Power, hosted by Robert Schuller, who broadcasts from the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove. And you know him because he has a big glasses and the white helmet of hair and always has a smile tattooed upon his face. Totally nice guy. He was also the first person to build a drive-in church. So that also came from Orange County. Last month, we had Barack Obama and John McCain do not a debate, but a discussion with a pastor, Rick Warren. Rick Warren's from Saddleback Church. Rick Warren's also, which is the third largest church in the United States, the third largest congregation. It's based in Lake Forest. Rick Warren is, which is a city in Orange County. Rick Warren is also the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, which, after the Bible, is the most bought nonfiction book in the history of American publishing. 45 million copies sold. Some of you folks might even, might follow The Purpose-Driven Life, at least very much know people. The ex-gay movement. Yes, I always forget to mention this, but it's so important right now. So maybe you've heard about people who say that they can turn gays into homosexuals if they just follow this, very, very expensive, very specific course. That started in Orange County. The ex-gay movement started in Orange County. The largest organization is called Exodus International. I don't know where they're based in, but they actually were started in Orange County by two guys who they thought they were gay. Then they said, okay, we're going to be heterosexual, and they married off until one day they were traveling across the country to tell people how they could no longer be gay, and they fell in love, and they were together for the rest of their life. That's a very telling story about Orange County. And then another major movement from Orange County is the Calvary Chapel movement. I'm sure you have it here in Colorado. Calvary Chapel movement is one of the largest evangelical movements of the past 40 years. That started in Orange County. It had an interesting genesis because originally the pastor who created that, Chuck Smith, he saved all the hippies. So you might remember the Jesus people, the Jesus freaks from 1970s, hippies who were just completely blown out on acid, then found God, and then Chuck Smith, bless his soul, he turned them into gay bashers. And so that's probably what they're most known for, especially in California, just very much anti-gay, even though one of the founders of Calvary Chapel, Lonnie Frisbee, he was a homosexual. But, they don't mention that in the histories. And so I go on and on that about religion. That's really something that's usually not acknowledged in the history of American Christianity, the important role that Orange County plays. I also talk about, there's one chapter, one of my favorite chapters, called The Beaner Bashing Capital of America. So Tom Tancredo, my favorite Tom Tancredo, everyone laughs. My favorite Tom Tancredo story is that only in Orange County could he have had a standing room only audience where they gave him an award, and the award was a blowtorch and devil's horns. And this is probably the only place where he was able to make any money for his lame presidential campaign. And he had it at the Richard Nixon Library. But Tancredo, he really took a lot of his philosophy from Orange County. The Minuteman Project was started in Orange County. All the different movements to try to give immigration powers to police officers or sheriff's departments, Orange County were the first cities in the country to do that. A lot of cities have problems with day laborers. Orange County was the city of Costa Mesa, and Orange County was the first city in the nation to propose building a day labor center to supposedly to get rid of the day labor problem that really only exacerbated the problem. The historic case Mendez versus Westminster. Anybody know Mendez versus Westminster? Nobody. Wow. We all know Brown versus Board of Education, right? Brown versus Board of Education, of course, desegregated American schools so that black and white kids could go together. But that case was actually based on a precedent. The precedent case was Mendez versus Westminster. The Westminster in question is a city in Orange County. And so in 1946, Mexican parents who came back from World War II or were coming back from World War II, they sued four school districts in Orange County because those school districts segregated the Mexican kids from the white kids. And the school district's justification was that these kids, they don't know any English, they're too dumb, they're never going to learn English, and so they don't even know nursery rhymes for crying out loud, so why should we mix them up with our white kids? So the parents sued, and then the district appealed, but it went up to the California State of Appeals. A friend of the court brief was Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, of course, would go on to argue Brown versus Board of Education, and he would also be the first African-American justice of the Supreme Court. A couple of years after Mendez versus Westminster was upheld in court, the governor of California signed a law that outlawed all segregation of any type for schools in the state of California, and that governor was Earl Warren. Earl Warren, of course, would go on to be the justice who decided Brown versus Board of Education. So, you know, a lot of hate, but also a lot of key things in the civil rights movement for Latinos in Orange County or in the United States came from Orange County. And then the final chapter then for the Orange County section is I just examined the way Orange County has influenced pop culture in the United States, from surf music to to just why a lot of people like to dress casual nowadays, dress like beach bums even though they're nowhere near the beach. I think it's very disturbing to the various musical movements, from punk to Rage Against the Machine to No Doubt, and then also the television shows that I talked about early. So that's one half of the book. And the way I tell, though, those stories, those histories of Orange County, is really through my family story. And that's the second part of the book, which I'll talk about right now. And that's also another part that I debunk. So the other obsession, of course, that I have is what some of you folks might know me for, which is, the issue of Mexican immigration. So in the second part of the book, in the introduction, I say there was really no reason why I had to write about my family's history, about my family's back and forth between Mexico and the United States, because the immigrant coming of age tale, pulling up your bootstraps, that's a cliche of American letters. There's hundreds of and thousands of books about that. But we're at a point in our nation's history where there's a lot of people out there, millions and millions of people who say Mexicans are different from the immigrants of the past because they're illegal and they never assimilate and they can't even tip you decently. So there's really a problem with the Mexican invasion. So what I set out to do then in my book was to give people a sense of what modern day Mexican migration is. So my family story then begins in 1918 when my great-grandfather and my grandfather, they came to Orange County to pick oranges, to live in the segregated citrus camps that I told you folks about earlier. They started a chain migration that continues to this day. My great-grandfather, my grandma, my grandfather, they come from a little, we call them ranchos, but they're villages called El Cargadero, which is up in the mountains in Zacatecas, next to a city called Jerez. And so it's a beautiful place, really is beautiful. It's famous around Mexico for its avocados. The only problem, though, is that it suffers a lot of debilitating droughts and frosts that keep ruining the crop year in, year out. Year in, year out. So over the past century, starting around the time when my great-grandfather, my grandpa came to Anaheim, El Cargadero started sending its children up north to Anaheim until, at its height, El Cargadero never had more than 750 people. Right now, there's at least 2,000 people living in Anaheim alone who can trace their roots back to El Cargadero. And that's the story of modern-day Mexican migration, where you have entire communities just transplanting themselves and putting themselves somewhere in, you know, in the United States. I'm sure in Denver there's people, like entire villages of people that have hundreds and hundreds of people living in Denver alone. So I use that story, though, also to tell the story of the children. So the immigrants themselves, well, they're probably going to retain a lot of the home country. And so that's from my mom's side. El Carguero is from my mom's side. And so she was born in Mexico, but she came to Anaheim around 9 years old so she could start picking strawberries. She had to drop out of school in ninth grade to pick strawberries and then became a tomato canner. In Anaheim, that's where she met my father. My father comes from a small village called Homulquillo. Homulquillo is right next to El Cargadero, but they met each other in Anaheim. My mom, she was able to come here legally because my grandma, she was an American citizen, Mexican, but she was born in Arizona Territory because her parents fled the Mexican Revolution and were working the copper mines there. But my dad, on the other hand, he came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy. And that was the first time he came here illegally. The second time, he cut a hole through a fence and then crawled through it and then just ran across the San Diego line. The third time, he just hopped that same fence and then just ran across. The fourth time, he just found a place that didn't have a fence, so he just moseyed on along and just went into the United States. Another time, he committed, some people would call identity theft, but he doesn't, because the identity that he used was that of his uncle, and his uncle gave him he gave him permission to use his identity, so it's not really theft. It's more like identity borrowing, I guess. For that, he was arrested, placed in jail for a couple of months, and then they sent him back. And the last time he came in, one of the last times he came in, he crawled through a sewer for about an hour. There was people in front of him, people behind him. It was about 3 miles or so. Sorry, I realized I had my cell phone on this entire time. So crawling through a sewer, he couldn't lift up his head. There was the sewer was basically filled with not. It was halfway filled with sewage, so he had to keep his head up so he wouldn't drown. Crawled through it for about an hour. Then it went from Tijuana, from Colonia Libertad, this really notorious barrio there, and it popped up in San Isidro, which is right across the border, and this open sewer was right next to a McDonald's, so you could always insert your Big Mac joke here. So they met in Anaheim. I'm the oldest of four, and so my book talks just about how they adjusted to life in the United States. Then it gets into my section, and you know, in my section again, I didn't want to tell my story because I wish everybody knew that the children of Mexican immigrants can actually succeed in this country. But there's a lot of people who don't know that. So I talk a lot about then my own upbringing. When I entered kindergarten, the only language I spoke was Spanish, and of course here I am speaking English. So I talk about how I learned English, so some of the funny stuff that went with that. My parents, my parents were not saints. A lot of times when people talk about legal immigrants or just Mexican immigrants, they try to make them into saints, but my parents weren't saints. I talk about my dad's alcoholism. My dad was abusive to my mom, but eventually he was able to get out of that, and he's been sober now for 25 years, so I'm very proud of him for that. But he would take me to AA meetings, so I talk about the AA meetings, how even to this day I know the Serenity Prayer and the 12 Steps, but only in Spanish. We never went to an English one, so if you ask me in English, I wouldn't be able to say any of that at all. In that, then, I also talk about how El Cargadero, my mom's rancho, how they reconstituted life in the United States. So we were all in Anaheim. The parents, my mom and her cousins and her friends of her generation, they all basically lived the life back in the rancho. But us children, we were the Americanized ones. We were the ones who, we spoke Spanish to our parents, but we spoke English amongst each other. And our parents had certain expectations of keeping this cargaderense identity. And so sometimes it wasn't good. So the excerpt that I'm going to read right now is actually comes from when I was around seventh or eighth grade, because at that time, I was becoming of age, and so my dad, he wanted me to dress like himself. So he wanted me to dress in the Stetson and the cowboy boots, a whole Mexican bit, but I really didn't want to. So I'm gonna read a little bit from that now. It's from the very beginning of the chapter on page 147 for those of you following at home. It's called Genesis and the Stetson. When my father dies, I'm going to decorate the mortuary with hats, giant sombreros and trucker's cachuchas, baseball lids stitched with the interlocked LNA of the Dodgers, cheap, smelly corduroy caps bought from swap meets and yard sales for 50 cents, wide-brimmed. In lieu of flowers, I'll ask mourners to donate tejanas, what Mexicans call Stetson 10-gallons, to their favorite Tijuana orphanage. My dad loves hats. There's a practical component to his infatuation. Male pattern baldness cruelly afflicts the Arellanos at a young age, which reminds me, does anybody know a good hatter? Because this is starting to fall off, unfortunately. Email me, which I have my email there. But the main reason he keeps more chapeaus than the average film noir tough guy is to keep up with the Mirandas. See, all the hombres from Jerez in the United States sport hats at least once a day, and probably sleep in them as well. The most popular choice is a tejana, and Papi kept at least four at any given time while I was growing up, and to this day. Each has a particular purpose. The sweat-stained one made of straw is for leisure time or to wear while maintaining his beloved lawn and palm trees. Black means it's time to play billiards. Creamy white signifies he's going to visit family. And if society calls, Dad dons a magnificent gray Stetson softer than cotton candy, a monument to machismo worth every peso of its $500 price. That glorious Stetson is just a capper to my father's regular outfit, pun intended. As important are the boots, pointy and sturdy enough to survive more than two decades. Jeans are a given for any male in America, but only the Mexican men are fabulous enough to pull off elaborately embroidered belts called cintos piteados, with bits of glitter sewn into arabesque curves made from the delicate threads of the agave plant, the same botanical Swiss Army knife of Mexico that produces tequila. A silver belt buckle holds the cinto piteado together. In a pinch, the buckle can double as a shovel. When I was growing up in the early 1990s, Papi wasn't the only overdressed Mexican in our Anaheim Jerezano colony, which had expanded from his native Homulquillo and Mom's El Cargadero to include other ranchos from Jerez, San Juan, El Porvenir, Rio Florido, Los Morales. Anthropologists have noted that individuals in poor society spend inordinate wealth on ludicrous, unnecessary items, and the men of Jerez practice conspicuous consumption like hedge fund investors. These immigrants earned enough money to move from apartments into Anaheim's cornucopia of tract housing, then transformed the neighborhoods into mini haciendas featuring imported tile, exotic trees, and fountains worthy of Tivoli. Any remaining gabachos white-flighted away. The typical Jerezano truck, meanwhile, and I've seen this in Denver, so it's not just our people, rumbled through streets like a mastodon, intended to feature a decal that read Jerez, whether as a dignified bumper sticker or individual Old English lettering. The ultimate peacock feather for Papi's generation, however, were clothes. Who sported the biggest belt buckle? Which feet slipped into the most exotic animal leather? I remember armadillo, alligator, ostrich, even fetal cows. Whose cinto piteado featured the most threading, and whose tejana featured the largest number of X's? Stetson ranks the quality of their cowboy hats with X's on the inside rim. My father only had a 10X hat. To be a big man, you had to start at 100X. Hey, we're working class. With such a sartorial fixation, you'd swear these machos were auditioning for Project Runway. Such attention to appearance didn't exist in the rancho. Poverty eliminates vanity pretty quickly. But it was essential to surviving El Norte. Not only did my father and his peers have to spend money like gabachos to prove they were well off and succeeding to everyone else, but a jerezano in the States needed to dress Mexican or face rancho gossipers banding around that most devastating of insult, pocho, a Mexican who has lost his heritage. Me. So I'll skip a little bit. And so basically what happened, my dad insisted that I had to dress like him, like a Mexican. And I wouldn't do it because, and my main reasoning, and I think it's perfectly logical, is that I've never seen a cowboy wear glasses. And I cannot sport, I love the look. If you could sport it, you can go ahead and sport it and rock it. But I can't do it. And in Western movies, the only people who wore specs were the people in the suits, the city slickers who tend to be a little, kind of weakling and skinny and so forth like that. But so I wouldn't be able to pull off a Stetson or boots. I would look ridiculous. But so finally, though, I bartered with my dad. I said, if you buy me a Sega Genesis, and maybe some of you remember the system, and for those of you who don't, it was the Wii and Xbox 360 of its day. It's a video gaming system. So I asked my dad, if you buy me a Sega Genesis, I will wear a Stetson. And so he said, okay, fine, let's do the deal. But first, you have to wear it first. So now I'm going to describe to you what happened. Oh, sorry. A couple of weeks after Papi and I made our deal, our Genesis deal, a group of young people stood in the driveway of my cousin Erica's house in East Los Angeles. No photographs exist of this day, and thank God for that. So let me attempt to describe the phony I was. Imagine a skinny kid. Imagine a skinny kid, 5 feet, 8 inches, no more than 130 pounds, with glasses as thick as a bank teller's window. Stuff him into super tight blue jeans, cuffs slightly frayed. Hang a bandana in the right back pocket right here, right back pocket, with Arellano printed in Old English font. What's with Mexicans and liking Old English? Seriously. That's in my first book, Ask a Mexican, actually. Add cheap black cowboy boots, a knockoff Stetson, and an itchy long sleeve shirt. Make sure the boots or jeans have not been broken into. Refry with insecurity. voila, we have a laughing stock. My parents, or actually my brother right now, my youngest brother, he's threatening me. He says that he has found pictures of me like this. And I'm begging him to just throw them away because it really was one of the most traumatic moments of my life, which means I've had a pretty good life, thank God. But it was just absolutely embarrassing. So I only wore the Stetson one time. I saw how ridiculous I looked, and I'd never done it again. I never did it again. Of course, I kept the Stetson. I never gave it back. And to this day, my dad will tell me, you were supposed to dress like me. You promised me, and you broke your promise. What, you know, you're not a good son. But I know he does it in kidding, because I know that deep down inside, he knew that I looked like a dork. He knew that he would probably be more embarrassed by me going around to the various dances dressed up like him. You know, he'd be embarrassed because people would laugh at me. So instead, I just, you know, for the rest of my years, I've always just worn suits and all that, try to be a little bit nice. So then from there, though, I talk more a little bit of my life. Again, always with the purpose of showing people that even from the lowest of the low, from being an elite legal immigrant, you could create something in this country. So we ended up moving from a small little granny, they call them granny flats, like one bedroom, one bath stuff, to we ended up buying a three bedroom, two bed house, my parents did, with a truck driver's salary and a tomato canner's salary. I went through high school. I was always a nerd from the very beginning, but I wasn't really a good student. So by my senior year, I talk about how I wanted to go to college, but I really didn't have the grades. But I told my dad I wanted to do that, and he insisted that I become a truck driver like him. And when I told him I didn't want to do that, he said, okay, you're just going to waste your time going to college. But eventually, I went to community college, got my bachelor's degree, got my master's degree. And then after me, though, I'm the oldest of four. So after me setting the example, my dad, he saw the light. And so he insisted, and in fact, he required that my sisters go to college, get an advanced degree. So I have two sisters now. Well, one sister with a master's degree, another one who's studying to be a doctor, so she'll go off there. And then the youngest, he's 17 and a senior in high school. Of course, he'll go to college as well. So by telling that story, I show people like, yeah, Mexicans, sometimes they might have some pathologies, but a lot of them overcome them. And then from there, I also talk about my own political awakening, my own fights and the immigration wars that are happening in Orange County. I end the book with this, I call it Becoming the Mexican. So I talk about the genesis behind the column and just sort of the little notoriety that I've been able to get. And I'll read one final thing and then I'll get to your questions, because people always ask me like, people always ask me, how was the Colbert Report? Because that's probably the best thing I've ever done in my career, coming on the Colbert Report. So where are we? Okay, do I do that? Okay, so here we go. The culmination of my odd rise to quasi-fame was marked by a July 2006 appearance on the Colbert Report. I've graced other, lesser shows. Hannity and Colmes, Good Morning America, Your World with Neil Cavuto, and various Fox News and CNN programs to opine on Mexican stuff. The New York Times, Houston Chronicle, the Reuters Newswire, and others have written glowing profiles. But to appear on Colbert meant a joke understood a joke. Satire across America translates into a better nation. Colbert's handlers flew me out to New York and put me in a boutique hotel. Once I got there, talent bookers promptly handed me a swag bag, three bottles of vodka, every flavor of Altoids imaginable, a gift certificate for custom-made shoes, and hangover pills that don't work. A six-pack of mini bottles of Shiraz. Under randomness, some granola bars I remember too. A Colbert Report tote bag. All the Today Show gave me was ranch dressing. Before the taping, Colbert stuck his well-coiffed head in the green room and thanked me again for agreeing to be his latest punching bag. Gabacho, gringo, gaijin, geek. Why do so many names for outsiders begin with the letter G? He rhetorically asked. Gustavo, too, I lamely cracked. He laughed, a sincere, warm laugh. I still bombed. In the show. After a commercial break, I was led into the studio. It was cold, the audience unimpressed. Not only did Colbert mispronounce my last name twice on air, he also had to re-record the opening because he stuttered through Arellano. It's okay, I called him a French Canadian. While on the show, Colbert asked me what was the Spanish word for patience. Paciencia, I asserted. Wrong. The word is paciencia. Within minutes of my returning to the hotel after the taping, angry Latinos from across the world had emailed in to bash me. These emails provided the only existential moment I've ever had about the column. I received hundreds of emails, gently chiding, laudatory, but most calling me a Hispanic Lou Dobbs, a vendido, a sellout. On the JetBlue flight back home, I started doubting the validity of the column. How much of an authority was I wondered, if I stumbled over freshman Spanish words such as paciencia? I skipped through the channels offered by JetBlue during the flight and noticed that Comedy Central was re-airing the Colbert Report episode. I cringed and I switched the channel to ESPN2. I nearly flipped out when I noticed a lady next to me had settled on the Colbert Report. My segment was up in about 10 minutes. After a final commercial break, I appeared. I stole glances at the lady's screen, shooting between her erupting laughter and my on-air fidgeting. About 2 minutes into it, her laughter stopped. She looked at me, looked at the screen, and looked at me again. "Is that you?" she asked with a twinge of doubt in her voice. "Yes," I nodded. "Good job, you're funny." And then I thought about my error. I had always translated patience as paciencia. I never recalled my parents correcting me, unlike so many other Spanish mistakes. In the book, I also talk about the various Spanish words. Like one time I told my mom that my sister was embarazada because I was trying to say she was embarrassed, and my mom nearly punched me. Embarazada means pregnant. Yeah, she nearly punched me, and my sister has never forgiven me for that one. So, but what was wrong with me with this mispronunciation? Was I woefully lacking in Mexican credentials and therefore exploiting my mother culture? Upon landing at Long Beach Airport, I immediately drove home to my parents' house. Everyone I knew saw the show and called me or texted me the days following the appearance to congratulate me. None of them mentioned my flub. I worried. "Congratulations, macho man," Papi proclaimed upon my return. I was hungry and heated up the stove to make a quesadilla. But first, I needed to know the truth. "Papi, ¿cómo se dice patience en español?" I asked nervously, fearing the answer. "Paciencia," he responded with little hesitation. "Paciencia." I turned to my mom. "Mami, ¿sí se dice patience así?" I asked. "Is that how you say patience?" "Pues no, se dice paciencia," she replied. Pero así se dice en el rancho. But that's how they say it in the rancho. Almost 40 years after my parents had left El Cargadero and Homulquillo for the States, the old country still was in their American sun. I smiled, turned on the rerun to see myself in the Colbert Report, and emailed the haters to go fuck themselves. So that's the book, Orange County Personal History. And it's two books in one, but there's actually a third component where I do city by, if any of you are ever in Orange County, I do city by city guides to it. And I also tell you what the best restaurants are in Orange County because I'm the food editor for the OC Weekly. And so I love talking about food whenever I can. So thank you very much for having me here. I really appreciate it. Please buy the book. And I forgot to say this, and I apologize for this, but even if you don't buy the book, just buy a book. Please support independent bookstores. They do such amazing things, and in this day and age with the changing bookstore industry, they need all the help you can get. So buy 30 copies of this book and then buy another book. So thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Candace Bushnell, Neal Stephenson, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 24th, 2008.